Hello, my name is Jody Lee Mott, and welcome to Dream Gardens, where we talk up the kids' books we love. On this twice-monthly podcast, I interview other kids' books enthusiasts, such as writers, teachers, and librarians, about their own favorite children's books. So this podcast, I'm going to continue as I have been for the past few podcasts, by starting with a poem. The one I'm going to read today is called My Grandmother Had One Good Coat, and it's by Tony Medina. I found it in the collection called Love to Mama, A Tribute to Mothers. This book was compiled by Pat Mora. Tony Medina, the author of the poem, is an associate professor of creative writing at Howard University. He's written several books for both adults and children, including such books as Deshawn Days and Love to Langston. My Grandmother Had One Good Coat by Tony Medina. My grandmother had one good coat, a black wool one with black buttons, shiny as patent leather shoes, and a smooth furry collar, just as black. She wore this only to the doctor or to church. One late afternoon, I came home from school feeling sorry for an old woman living beneath the elevated train below the station, who sat taunting passers-by on their way to work and to school. She sat coatless on a cardboard box, hiding her pain behind curses and scowls. She could have been my own grandmother. And the thought of my own grandmother, homeless, in the cold with no place to pray and be warm, made me sad and depressed. When she asked me what was wrong, and I told her without hesitation, she went into her closet and handed me her black dress coat, and said, "Here, put it in a shopping bag. You'll find one in the broom closet. I don't use it that much anyway." My guest today is author Beth Rabel, author of the Pack of Dorks series, A Blind Guide to Stinkville, and her most recent book, Caleb and Kit. You can find Beth's website at www.bethvrabel.com. Thank you for joining me today, Beth.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to talk with you about my favorite thing, books.
I noticed on your website that you said you've been writing since you were 8 years old. Now, that transition from, you know, writing because you enjoy it to becoming a professional writer, I was wondering, is that sort of a gradual decision that's made over time, or is it sort of a sudden decision, or something happened that you suddenly decided, this is what I really want to do as a career?
It was gradual. I always knew I wanted writing to be deeply important to my career, the center point of my career. But I wasn't convinced that I could hack it as a fiction writer. That was my first love, you know, back when I was a small child. And then I studied journalism in college. I was a journalist for almost a decade, most of that freelance time after the birth of my children. And I think that helped motivate me more than anything to go into fiction writing, because there is nothing like being a community reporter to introduce you to the reality that everybody has a story and everybody cares very passionately about their story. And I was really able to tap into that as a journalist, working for a features department with an absolutely phenomenal set of editors who not only wanted us to report the news, but show the people. And being able to blend this love of fiction writing that I had as a small child, this love of storytelling, with authentic portrayals of people and what they go through has been just a tremendous privilege. I started going from being a freelance writer, a journalist, to being a fiction writer around the time that my son, who is 10 now, about the time that he was about one, he would take a nap in the afternoon and I'd have, you know, an hour, 2 hours to myself to get everything in the house done. But I made a promise to myself that I'd spend 20 minutes a day just writing for myself. And being able to fall back into that, as you said, writing for myself, for my own stories, was really just intoxicating. It became those 20 minutes stretched into the full 2.5 hours almost every day.
As I mentioned, your latest book is called Caleb and Kit. It came out fairly recently. What can you tell us about that book?
Caleb and Kit is a story about friendship. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, Jody, where you've had to kind of break up with a friend, even someone that you really care about, somebody that is perfect for you and for that phase in your life, you reach a point where the friendship needs to sort of bend in a different direction. And at its core, that's what Caleb and Kit is about. It's about two kids who meet each other at the exact perfect time in their lives over the course of one summer. And Caleb has a very structured, rigid life. He was born with cystic fibrosis, and that involves a lot of treatment, a lot of proactive care, as well as reactive care to different illnesses. It's a tightly regimented life. And he meets Kit, this wild girl in the woods who kind of lives by this mantra of, I do it what I want. And they bring out this aspect of each other that they both desperately need. But as they become closer and spend more and more time together, Caleb begins to realize that life isn't as magical for Kit as he wants it to be, as he would like it to be, and as she pretends it to be. And he has to make that difficult decision of whether being a good friend means staying by your friend, keeping her secrets, or if it means allowing yourself to grow in a different direction for the sake of both of them.
And when did this book come out?
September 12th.
Now, this is one of many books that you've written, and I'm wondering, what's the process whenever you start a new book? What is that? How does that go?
I like to kind of mine my own experiences. That was kind of the winning combination for Pack of Dorks. While that was my first book, it was the fourth one that I've written. The first one was kind of an experiment to see whether I could finish a book. The second one was very similar to other books that were already out there. The third one, I got a little closer. You know, each one was kind of a learning process, but with Pack of Dorks, I was able to delve into some of my own personal experiences and reimagine them, relive them, give myself a different ending, and that seems to work for me. After Pack of Dorks came out, I thought, well, that wasn't original. That wasn't creative of me to have mined my own experiences so much, and I tried very hard to write something, create a fresh, new myself outside the storytelling itself. And it was a total disaster. By page 17, all of my characters were dead. They just could not breathe any life into the story at all. And it's really hard to write a funny, realistic, middle grade story when all of your characters are dead by page 17. So, I realized I needed to embrace, lean into those experiences that I've had in my life that I know to be true and bring them onto the page. And in doing so, I was able to actually write stories that are very different than my own experiences. They have that core, that root of authenticity and of experience, but they've blossomed into much different paths than my own personal experiences. So that's what works for me.
The book you chose as one of your favorites is called The Wednesday Wars by Gary D. Schmidt. This was published in 2007 by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. For readers who aren't familiar with this book or haven't had a chance to read yet, what can you tell them about it?
It's absolutely delightful. If you're looking for a really enchanting, powerful, discussion-oriented book to read to your children at night, go pick up this book. It is set in 1967, around the Vietnam era. And you have Holland Hood, who just started seventh grade, and he is just discovering himself. And I think that's partly the beauty of middle grade, is that's at an age where kids start to realize that they don't have to conform as much as they can also stand out. And that's really what Holland grapples with throughout this whole novel, is where he stands in the world. He has a very domineering, father is always best parent. He has a teacher that he thinks might hate him, who ends up being his biggest cheerleader. And he has this wonderful set of friends. And it's the Holling's experience throughout that entire school year and how he just brings to life everyone around him. And it's also a story about stories, which I'm always a sucker for. Each character has his own story or her own story going on. And Schmidt just does an amazing job of braiding those all together into one solid, powerful book.
Is there anything about this book in particular that really made it stand out for you from any other books as being a particular favorite of yours?
I think more than anything, it's the voice for Holland Hood. I suppose you would say he's an unreliable narrator in that as you're reading the book, you pick up on things that Holling hints at or observes, but you know that his interpretation is skewed from his own experience, such as, for example, his teacher, Mrs. Baker. You see, as a reader, the things that she's doing for his benefit, to champion him and to guide him, that he sees as her hating him, as her throwing up hurdles to him or making his life miserable. Things like forcing him to read Shakespeare and the lessons that he is able to pull out of these Shakespearean plays. You know, initially he thinks that he's pulling one over on her because, you know, this Shakespeare guy knew how to swear like nobody else. And, you know, now he has this plethora of curses that he can spew out at people in his classroom. But the wider lessons are more slow to come to the surface. And it's just, the pacing is so beautiful. The voice is just impactful. And again, as a read aloud, as a parent reading this to my children, I find myself, you know, holding in laughter, holding back tears, the whole gamut. It's just so lush and beautiful.
Just wondering if you want to talk a little bit about how the author uses history as a background for the character rather than having the character actually participating in the history.
I find this time period really interesting. It's kind of, I was born 12 years after the setting for this story, so I'm not, you know, I don't have the personal experience with it, but in my mind it's so romanticized. It's such a, romanticized is probably a bad word for it, but it's such a pivotal time in our history. And to be able to hear what it's like to actually live through some of these events that changed our culture, changed our country, such as Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, the protests for the Vietnam War, wondering what it was like to have your friends and neighbors serving. To have that be brought to life really added to my understanding of what our nation has been through. I read that Schmidt read all of the New York Times from that year to prepare for this. And I think that level of research really comes through because, as you said, the book isn't about 1967. It's not about that year. It just takes place in that year. And I think he was able to do that because for him, by the time his research was done, these events were just so ingrained in his knowledge base that they were able to just, you know, support the story rather than be the story. And that's a goal of mine too. And, you know, not to go back to Caleb and Kit, but with Caleb having cystic fibrosis, I had to do a tremendous amount of research on what that is. And I couldn't write the book until I stopped that learning phase and was able to just sort of recognize what Caleb's routine would be like, that I wasn't constantly, you know, putting down the writing and pulling up research or calling friends who live with this illness and asking for their input. But when I got to the point where I felt like I had a stronger grasp on the reality of that life, that's when it could be part of the story and not be the story.
You mentioned earlier about how his teacher, Mrs. Baker, uses a variety of Shakespeare plays. She makes Holling read a number of different plays throughout the school year to reflect on them. Sometimes she quizzes on them. And like I said, at first it's the curses, but later he starts to see connections between the plays and his own life. And I just want, if you want to talk a little bit more about how Shakespeare is introduced into this book as a way of Holling learning more about himself and his life.
Absolutely. In fact, if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to read a part of the book that I think plays to that point.
Absolutely.
On page 72. At the happy ending of the Tempest, Prospero brings the king back together with his son, finds Miranda's true love, and punishes the bad duke, frees Ariel, and becomes a duke himself again. Everyone, except for Caliban, is happy, and everyone is forgiven, and everyone is fine, and they all sail away on calm seas. Happy endings. That's how it is in Shakespeare. But Shakespeare was wrong. Sometimes there isn't a Prospero to make everything fine again, and sometimes the quality of mercy is strained. And I think that just speaks to how the story not only blends in Shakespeare, but shows Holling's growth through it, because at this point, this is still early on in the book, and he's questioning Mrs. Baker's tactics. He's questioning the purpose of learning these stories. But later in the book, at the very end, you see the flip-flop of that. You see him coming to the realization that the reason Shakespeare's stories are universal is that at various points in the story, just as various points in a person's life, you can come to different conclusions with the same set of information. And if you don't mind, can I read a part of that too?
Of course.
Awesome. This is from page 262. And at this point, versus the beginning, when everything seems to be piled up against not only Holling, but the community, with more and more citizens being drafted to war and more demands being hoisted against Holling from his father and from the school. Toward the end, things seem to be reaching a peace. Mrs. Baker's husband is coming back from the war. He had been missing in action for quite some time, and she just received word that he would be home in time for the strawberries, which I thought was another beautiful phrasing on Schmidt's part. I'll just pick that up there. Mrs. Baker, smiling Mrs. Baker, did not look away from the strawberries she was holding. "I'm sure of it," she said. Now I smiled. "Do teachers always know the future?" "Always," she said. "Shall I tell you yours?" Standing there in the music of the bar mitzvah party, feeling the weight of what had happened in the synagogue, I saw again the glittering stream with its light rushing toward me. "Don't tell me," I said. "But how do you know?" She looked away from the strawberry and at me. "Do you remember Don Pedro standing alone at the end of the play?" I nodded. "Claudio has Hero and they'll be fine. Benedict has Beatrice and they'll be fine. Everyone has everyone else and they'll all be fine. The only one who's left alone is Don Pedro. They all go off to dance and leave him behind. And they don't even remember that he's the one who has to deal with a traitor tomorrow, or that he hasn't got anyone." "That's right," said Mrs. Baker. "And maybe his whole country will split into pieces. He doesn't have any idea what's going to happen to him." "Great comedy," I said. "A comedy isn't about being funny," said Mrs. Baker. "We talked about this before. A comedy is about characters who dare to know that they may choose a happy ending after all. That's how I know." "Suppose you can't see it." "That's the daring part," said Mrs. Baker. I think that's just such a, you know, not to spoil the ending for people who haven't read The Wednesday Wars, but I think that just speaks to the tremendous amount of growth that this character goes through in the course of this rather short novel.
You mentioned earlier, too, about in the beginning they have this antagonistic relationship, Mrs. Baker and Holling, and throughout the book he starts to see her as more of a full human being. I'm wondering if you think that's a very common thing with kids, to see their teachers either as the enemy or just somebody who's not quite human as others in their lives.
Oh, absolutely. I really wish that I had a camera for the time that my son saw his kindergarten teacher at the grocery store. It was like this complete look of shock, like they leave the school building. You know, just the whole idea that like you said, a teacher is a human, has experiences outside of that classroom, can be a really mind-blowing thing for a child. You know, I think even when I look back at my teachers in middle school or primary school, you know, you do sort of think of them as just that. You don't think of what else was influencing them throughout that year that you had them. And that's normal. I think children are naturally really somewhat self-centered for quite some time. And it's about middle school that circle seems to broaden and you start to realize that other people have just as many desires and passions and wants that you also have.
Now, there's another relationship in the book, relationship arc, that's a bit more of a minor arc, but it parallels the one between Holling and Mrs. Baker. And I'm thinking of the one between Holling and his sister. Starts out again and as enemies, and then it changes into something else by the end of the book. And I just wanted to talk about that, how that sort of goes throughout the book. And it's very similar in some ways to the one between him and Mrs. Baker.
Absolutely. And I think it's also very authentic that they're not always on the same side. They're often rivals, but when one needs the other, they are just 100% there for each other. There's a part where Heather, who is a teenager at this time, runs away from home to find herself. And his mother is devastated, but silent. The father acts as though it does not affect him whatsoever, although it very clearly does. And it's up to Holland to take any sort of action about it, which he does at his own expense. And not just monetarily and risking being in trouble with Mrs. Baker, but also risking the wrath of his father, which can be pretty overpowering. And he does it without hesitation. I think that's another really cool, it brings me to another really cool technique that Gary Schmidt has in this book is, you don't, or at least I didn't, pick up on his sister's name until that part of the story. And suddenly it goes from my sister to Heather. You know, she's a fully realized person. Same way throughout the whole book. Another villain is Doug Sweetick's brother, who is just known throughout the whole book as Doug Sweetick's brother, which I thought was just such a really clever technique for showing how Holling views the world.
Now, we talked about a lot of characters have this change from the beginning to the end. One character who doesn't seem to change too much is Holling's father. Although he goes through a lot, he's pretty much the same person he is at the end. But in some ways, Holling's relationship with his father is not the same at the end as it is in the beginning.
Absolutely. I think that passage that I read at the end was about characters who dare to know they may choose a happy ending after all. It was speaking directly to that relationship because Holling's dad feels it's his right to dictate his children's futures. Holling will take over the architectural firm that his father has created. No question about it, that's going to be Holling. And because his sister is a female, she is going to be his secretary. There's no college for her. There are no other options. He's dictated, this is what I want. And Holling talks about how he lives in the perfect house. You know, to the outside, it's the perfectly manicured lawn, the perfectly situated home, the perfect living room that no one's allowed to go into. And Holling's dad, I think, feels as though he's creating a perfect future, but it's his vision for that perfect future. And I think to a wider scale, his character is that belief that the country cannot change as well, that there's this cultural shift going on at that point in our history where people are questioning the norms and the realities of what had been accepted for so long. And it's changing, and it's uncomfortable for some. It's liberating for most, but it's uncomfortable for some. And I think that that's what's happening with Holling's dad as well, is he's trying so hard to stick onto this self-perceived reality, whereas Holling is realizing he's his own person, and Mrs. Baker is helping him reach that idea that he can be daring, he can choose a different future, he can give himself the ending that he desires.
Just one last thing. One thing we haven't really touched upon in the book is the humor that's in the book. Although there are a lot of serious moments, it's equally balanced with a lot of very funny moments as well. And I don't know if you want to talk about that a little bit, about the humor in the book.
Oh my gosh, it's so funny. We were cracking up reading this together when I was reading this to my son. And it again goes to the voice with Holling. He has such a marvelous way of sharing what's happening, leaving you to kind of color in the blanks. After Holling is first introduced to Shakespeare through Mrs. Baker, he finds himself in a situation where he has to bring these perfectly brown, delicious cream puffs to school or he's going to get annihilated by his classmates. And it just so happens that the baker is looking for an actor in a Shakespearean play. And because of his knowledge with Mrs. Baker, Holling is able to work out this deal with the baker that he'll be in the play if he can have these cream puffs. And unfortunately, Holling is playing the role of Ariel the fairy, and he has to wear a costume that includes a yellow jumpsuit with white feathers on the and as Holly puts it, on the you know where, you know, rather than admit where it is. And then it gets to the point where he actually has to spell out where these feathers are. It's just the most hilarious thing, and I think it's such a gift from that Gary Schmidt had, that all of his books are just so able to crack you up, but at the same time to squeeze your heart when he needs to, and to be able to go from that, from one page to the next. It's just tremendous talent and storytelling.
Now, I know you've had a chance to share a couple of passages from the book. Were there any other passages that you wanted to share?
Those were the two that really struck me more than any other part, but the entire book is just so ripe for the picking. When we finished it, something my son said to me that really struck me, kind of had me pause and think for a minute, was that the very end, Holling talks about how Mrs. Baker's husband has returned, and he was able to be there and see him reunite with her. And he talks about how not everything is fixed in the country or in this home at that time, but it was still a happy ending. And as I closed it, I said, oh, I'm so glad that Lieutenant Baker made it home. And my son pointed out that we never met Lieutenant Baker, that he was alluded to throughout the book, but he was never actually introduced. And he said, how amazing is it that he's a character we cared about anyway, and we never even met him. And I think that that's one of the greatest things about this book, is that you do care for all of the characters. Even in a small way, you care for Holling's father. You might really be furious with him, but you still see how you have an opportunity to sympathize with him in a small way. He's definitely the antagonist of the story. He's definitely not going to be your favorite character. You might not even be fond of him by the end of the book, but you can understand him a little bit more. And I love flawed characters. I love characters who grow and change through the book, and this one is just full of those.
Well, Beth, thank you for taking the time to talk to me today about this book and share it with us. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You can find Beth's website at www.bethfrabel.com. Thank you for joining me on Dream Gardens. The theme music titled All Together is provided courtesy of Purple Planet Music. You can visit them at www.purpleplanet.com. Podcast cover art is provided by Creative Pro 180, courtesy of Fiverr, which can be found at www.fiverr.com. You can visit me at jleemott.com or follow me on Twitter at DreamGardensJLM. The Dream Gardens podcast is also available through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. If you like what you hear, please comment, share, or subscribe. Until next time, keep dreaming, keep growing, and keep reading.